Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 23rd, 2010. You know, we love to talk money management on this show and even how to teach your kids to be financially savvy. But, you know, it turns out there's only so much education can do because some aspects of our money management may be hardwired.
We learned that indeed about 30% of the decision to participate in the stock market seems to go back to genetic variation across people.
That's coming up, and later on we'll take a look at the call for banks to modify more than the interest rate on troubled mortgages. Some want a reduction in the principal.
Why can't they put some skin in the game? We have skin in the game. Why can't they put some in? Why did they get a bailout?
Those stories and more are coming up on this, your favorite podcast. But first, the Financial Reform Act is now law. The president signed it this week, and today we're going to look at one small piece of it. It's called the Office of Financial Literacy, and it's within the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, we here are all for financial literacy, of course, but we wondered what the government might add to what is already an enormous amount of information for consumers. So we turn to Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Tess.
You know, it's been said that in Washington, commissioning a study is basically the equivalent of letting ideas go to die. Now, part of this legislation calls for a year-long study about financial literacy. Why do we need another study on this? Don't we know at this point that there's a lot of work to be done here?
Right. Well, the legislation does call specifically for two studies within this section on financial literacy and financial education, but they're very specific. One is a report that basically, just an annual report that looks at what progress this Office of Financial Education is making. You know, how well are they improving the financial literacy of Americans? And I think that's a good thing, you know, looking at real metrics and real progress. But the second study is investigating the feasibility of certifying expertise in terms of financial literacy. In other words, the House initially proposed that we offer basically financial counseling certification for community groups, and there's some sort of specific certification program. And then the Senate pulled back on that and said, wait a second, you know, this is just a small office. Can we really do that? And so that's what the controller of the currency is going to do. So I don't see this as, you know, study after study, sort of the academic halo of where do we keep going and going and studying and studying. I see this as two very concrete studies that are much needed to figure out how do we attack the issue of financial literacy.
Well, if you were advising them, how would you say to get started on this kind of thing? I mean, I suppose, first of all, it's good that we're addressing the literacy issue, but how do you start tackling that when so many other organizations have already tried?
Working with the grassroots groups that are out there already, you know, going back to President Obama's grassroots, I think is the right decision in terms of getting the money out there to organizations that already do financial literacy, getting it to the groups that are out there educating people. You know, at the point at which somebody is about to get a mortgage, making sure they understand what are they getting. At the point at which somebody is about to get a credit card, making sure they're getting unbiased information and they know what the interest rate is on their credit card. You know, the government earlier on this year did do a financial literacy study on what percentage of people understand what the interest rate is on their highest credit card. And astoundingly, one in three people don't know that interest rate.
What do you think would be the most effective way to get the basics of personal finance out to the public?
I think that often, you know, we're so trapped in this media, internet world. And I think there's something to be said for human contact. I think when somebody finally gets that credit card, if it's a person they can interact with, or, I mean, this new agency now, this new consumer agency is going to have a hotline for people to call with complaints, but also with questions. So if there's some sort of human contact that you can get that isn't, you know, a broker selling you a stock or isn't a mortgage broker pushing you toward a mortgage, I think that really makes a huge difference for people.
Beth Kobliner is the author of Get a Financial Life. She is a longtime advocate of financial literacy, and we've been talking about the new financial reform bill. Also a very good friend of the show. Beth, always nice to have you on. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
You certainly don't need a degree in financial literacy to know that being unemployed makes life much, much tougher. Although I guess the more financially literate you are, the more prepared you'll be in case that happens. But at the very least, people who lose their jobs have counted on unemployment benefits. Until a couple of months ago, when federal money for those benefits ran out and they were not resuscitated by Congress until this week. We asked economist Richard DeKayser whether the new extension means benefits are back to where they were for the unemployed.
Almost. The previous set of benefits actually had a $25 kicker. It was part of the stimulus legislation. That's not going to be part of the new benefits going forward, but in every other respect, they will be fully reinstated. And additionally, there's going to be back payments made.
But before you start breathing a little easier, this new extension isn't intended to be a long-term fix. It's only effective until November 30th.
Unless there's any dramatic change in the labor market, we'll be confronting the same reality again of expiring benefits, people potentially rolling off the dole, and sadly we'll be back in the same place we've been in the past couple of months.
But there's also the debate as to whether unemployment benefits actually discourage people from looking for work. DeKayser says there is evidence to back up that claim, but with a big caveat.
Making benefits available for a longer period of time and making them more generous does discourage employment, but the magnitude of that is very, very small. You could argue in the current environment that job availability is still relatively slim, and in their opinion, the difference in the jobless rate was only about 0.4% as a consequence of these more extended and more generous unemployment insurance benefits.
And, you know, another aspect of this that you often hear about is that, you know, look, if you take these unemployment benefits away from people who don't have jobs, that's money that's not going back into the economy.
Well, it stands to reason that this is one of the single most effective means of economic stimulus that we could possibly think of. Generally, the savings rate is somewhere around 3 or 4%. Now, I think it's fair to assume that unemployed people are doing less saving and more spending out of whatever income they can get. And what that implies is that virtually all of the money being provided is going directly into the economy.
Richard DeKayser is the president of Woodley Park Research, and you can also find him in the pages of Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. We were talking earlier about government involvement in financial literacy, yet like so many things in life, a huge amount of what we know or don't know is because of mom and dad. But even if they showed you how to budget, took you with them to the bank, you may still be terrible with money. And asking yourself why you did that silly thing when you really do know better. It's a question we mull frequently.
Let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
What were you thinking? It's our look at why we do what we do with our money. Turns out parents may not have much influence at all on their kids' spending habits as adults. Anne Dordfeldt has our story.
Kate Ramsey and Meg Dinas are navigating the maze of clothing racks at Macy's in Seattle to find just the right tank top.
Look how much it costs. It's $68.
And it's like a looser, cute tank
top. Well, it's cute, but I mean...
But would you spend $68 on a tank top?
No.
A cotton tank top?
No. That's crazy.
If Ramsey and Dinas sound alike, it's because they're identical twins. They were raised to have identical spending habits, too. Like when those Cabbage Patch Kid dolls came out in the 80s. Every girl had to have one.
And I remember not having enough money. So Grandma went and bought the Cabbage Patch dolls. And so then she hung on to them, and we had to save up and give her, like, $5 here, $5 there, until we paid off the Cabbage Patch doll, and then we could have it.
Yeah, she kind of held it on layaway for us. I forgot about that. And so we'd see it there sitting on our table every time we came over. It was kind of incentive to save.
These days, the twins have very different lives. Both are married, but Meg's a stay-at-home mom with two young boys. Kate's a web designer with no kids. Still, they have similar financial philosophies. Meg sticks to a tight household budget.
That's the money I have for the 2 weeks, and when it's gone, we're just eating canned foods out of the pantry.
Kate doesn't rack up credit card debt.
I just have that same mentality. If I don't have the money, I can't spend it, you know?
But are they frugal because they're twins or because they had the same upbringing? Stefan Siegel looked into that question. He's a University of Washington professor who studies household financial decisions.
It starts basically with the basic question, how much money do people, for example, save in a given period? And then it goes on to, if they save something, how do they invest that?
Siegel says the twins' similar spending habits are partly shaped by their shared DNA. He and his fellow researchers recently compared the spending habits of identical twins and fraternal twins in Sweden. Identical twins have the exact same DNA. Fraternal twins have different sets of genes. What Siegel found is that identical twins' financial habits were a lot more similar. That suggests a genetic link to how people manage their money.
We learned that indeed about 30% of the decision to participate in the stock market seems to go back to genetic variation across people.
So to translate, Siegel's saying 30% of our financial decisions are based on traits we were born with. If that's so, does upbringing shape the other 70%? Siegel says yes, but only to a point. As young adults, all the twins tended to handle money along the same lines as their parents. But by age 30, people's personalities and their own experience with money seem to override whatever their parents taught them.
And that was actually, I think, to us the most surprising finding.
So we can stop bothering to tell our children how to spend their money.
Yeah, that's sort of in the long run true.
All you have to do is look at Meg Dinas' kids to see how different personalities play out in spending habits. Meg says 6-year-old Mick has always been a saver. He's considering becoming a banker like his dad. 4-year-old Jake is much more liberal with his finances. Mick's teaching the boys how to save money by giving them marbles for good behavior. Mick's marble jar is pretty full compared to Jake's. Mick estimates his marble balance.
97. 99, I mean.
And Jake, how many marbles do you have?
I don't know. Like 37.
Okay.
When the boys have earned 30 marbles, they can trade them in for a $5 toy, or they can save them. For 4-year-old Jake, the decision's a no-brainer.
Weren't we talking about maybe next week we were going to go to Toys R Us, Jake, since you earned your 30 marbles? And are you going to spend your marbles, or are you going to save them?
Spend.
Meanwhile, Mick says he's never spent his marbles or his birthday money.
Because there's stuff that's, like, really big that I really want, but I won't be able to ever have it. If I keep spending my money, it'll take longer to get it, and that's why.
So for parents worrying about how to teach their kids how to handle money, there's only so much you can do. The rest is either hardwired into your kids' DNA, their personality, or they'll have to learn it in the school of hard knocks. In Seattle, I'm Ann Dornfeld for Marketplace Money.
It's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much.
Now, I have asked this of all of our experts that we bring in for this segment, so I'm going to ask you as well for a little bit of reaction to the new Financial Reform Act. It's no longer bill signed by the president this week. Good, bad, indifferent.
Pretty good, let's say.
Yeah,
it could have been a lot better. From a consumer's point of view, which is probably how a lot of the listeners are looking
at
it, there are some things to like. For instance, the creation of a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. That's a very good thing. The question mark here is, as the bill had originally been intended, it would be a completely independent watchdog agency with real teeth. Now it is under the auspices of the Federal Reserve, but we're told that it's going to have so much autonomy that Ben Bernanke can't walk in and start calling audibles at any time he pleases. All right, you know, we'll have to see how that works out, but this is going to be overseeing mortgages, credit cards, payday loans, all sorts of things that a lot of consumers care about, so that's a good thing.
Anything not here that you were hoping to see?
Yeah, a firmer hand on the financial industry. These guys fought tooth and nail to prevent more parental supervision of their operations.
And on the consumer level, you cannot get a mortgage if you can't prove to me that you can pay for it.
And this is a good thing. There's no question that the lending industry had gotten incredibly reckless.
Yeah.
And, of course, consumers are going to be stepping up to some of that. If there's a guy with a lemonade stand down at the corner saying, hey, I've got free money, well, people are going to line up for free money.
Absolutely.
That's just our nature. We're not going to question it. We're going to go, hey, he's giving out free money. It's good that they raised the bar. That doesn't mean that worthy people should not be getting the loans they need either to buy a home or operate a small business or do whatever they need to do. But at the same time, free money, it's not a good business plan.
How about free advice? Is that a good business plan?
I love free advice. I live for it.
Well, let's give some out, shall we? David, we've got Sam on the line. He's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Sam.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. How do you catch the show there in Florida?
NPR on WLRN.
WLRN. All right. Terrific. And I hear that you have an interesting job. You work in a place where everybody knows your name.
I'm a bartender.
I'm guessing I'm not the first person who made that joke.
Well, actually, no. Usually it's like Sam, because my name is Sam, that go, oh, you're like, I'm going, yeah, yeah, but I'm a lot better looking than he is.
All right.
Dude, way to play. Like,
yeah.
How long you been slinging drinks?
Let's see. Probably over 25 years. I've been in the restaurant business for about 35 years.
Nice. Well, so I guess you know what's in, a Singapore sling or maybe a rusty nail?
Yes, a rusty nail is scotch and drambuie.
And David, have you ever had one of those?
No, it sounds lethal.
I've only had one in my foot, for which I had to go and get a tetanus shot. And that
yeah,
was
exactly.
not pleasant at
that
all.
That one I know from, yeah.
Oh, that's cute. I like that.
Sam, why do people like to tell their problems to bartenders?
It's called liquor. I think it's basically, it's like anything else. You get a glass of wine in you, your inhibitions are lower, you know, and you just feel more relaxed. And you can see it. People come in. Sometimes they're a little stressed from work. They have one cocktail. They start having a good time. They start laughing. And I'm not talking about getting drunk. I'm just talking about they loosen up and,
right.
you know, they kind of let their problems go. So that's probably why they like to tell us things that we really don't want to hear sometimes.
But, Sam, it's been my experience that the best bartenders aren't just the ones with an encyclopedic knowledge of mixed drinks, but also they're just naturally good listeners.
Yes, that's actually true. You have to be kind of like everything. You have to be a good comedian. You have to be best friend to everybody in the bar, and you have to not seem like you're catering to any one person.
It's tricky.
Well, tell you what, given that you're such a good listener, why don't we turn the tables on you? We'll listen, share what's on your mind. What brings you to our neck of the woods?
Well, I was actually, I bought some land about 2 months ago, and I paid for it outright, and I wanted to build a cabin on it. Found a place that actually does pre-construction cabins and delivers them down.
Hmm.
I've stashed some money away. I did buy the land. I had heard about something where it's not called a project loan, but it's a loan for construction, and it takes care of everything. And the whole total cost is probably going to run anywhere from $70,000 to $80,000.
Is this going to be what, like a retirement home for you, or are you going to rent it out? What's the purpose of this?
No, it's going to be a secondary home for probably 3 or 4 years, and then it's going to be my permanent home in maybe 5 years.
Okay, so and what's this loan called again?
Well, it's like a construction loan.
Hmm.
That's not what it is. I read about something where the bank will finance like a project.
Okay.
In other words, they will pay in sections. They will pay as the project's going. Now, I may have misunderstood it, but I've heard different people talk about it.
All right. Well, David, first question, is this familiar to you, a construction loan? And second, does this sound like a good plan?
Sam is basically in an interesting position where he's a guy who needs a bowl of vanilla ice cream and he's getting ready to order a parfait. And I think simplicity in a situation like this should be the watchword. Now, a construction loan is a tricky little critter. Basically, these are intended for guys who are building condos or resorts, and it's a way that the bank is able to dole out money for a project where the money will come rolling in at the back end when the project is completed. So everyone goes into it understanding that.
Doesn't sound appropriate for residential.
It is absolutely not the right loan for a guy who's tending bar in Florida and kind of living that life. This is the Donald Trump loan. Now, Sam, considering everything you've told me, I want to strongly urge you to keep this thing as straightforward and plain vanilla as you can. And don't get in over your head. Don't go in too quick for something you can't afford. So if you're looking at some fixed costs, go into it with your eyes open so that when you sit down with a lender, you can be real transparent about what this project's going to cost. I think you're definitely on the right track with the prefab cabin. I've even seen some prefabs. They're not bad.
Sam, have you talked with a banker about a more traditional mortgage?
Well, no, because, again, this is down the road, and I was going to wait till I got closer to the point of actually buying the home, which was about 6 months. My credit is really good. The down payment I'm not worried about because I was thinking of using the land as collateral. But
David, does he want to be using his land as collateral to build a house on the land?
He absolutely does not. He is going to be leveraging his key asset to build another asset that puts him behind the eight ball from the get-go. I think the bigger problem you have, Sam, is as a guy who is a bartender and in the service industry and in a very cash-rich service industry, your only concern is how are you going to explain this big pile of undeclared money that you probably have under your mattress that you're going to be using to fund this thing. That's where you need to be going, dude.
You want Uncle Sam knocking on your door there.
My name is Bob, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's not in Florida. He's
no,
in
he's
Tennessee.
In Dallas, Texas. Yeah.
I'm in North Carolina. What are you talking about?
So what are your options then, Sam, do you think? I mean, it, we're telling you don't use your land as collateral to build this house. So do you have the ability to build the house at all?
Well, since my name is Bob and since I do live in North Carolina, I do have the amount to put down. I just was hoping not to use cash to do it. So that's, you know.
Okay,
I
hey, Bob, I got two words for you, money and laundering. And what you're going to be doing is moving this pile of cash into, say, a money market fund that'll keep your risk low. Do not do it in any lot over $10,000. Because that's where
not that we're encouraging you to hide your money from the IRS.
Yes, exactly. Not that we're doing anything like that, except that a bank has to report deposits of over $10,000. I'm just saying, get that money out there, start building it up legitimately, and that would be the way that somebody, not you, of course, but somebody would be doing this.
Okay. All right. That sounds more realistic, I guess.
Well, thanks so much for the call, and good luck there.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Let's go to Jeremy from Los Angeles. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Is the IRS your best friend, I hope?
Oh, yes. I send them love letters every April.
Oh, you're... that's so nice.
What a smart man.
All right, so how do you hear the show, Jeremy?
Oh, I hear it on KPCC here in Los Angeles.
Yay, KPCC, our hometown radio station. I have to tell you, you've got a very nice voice. You sound like you've got a bit of a radio voice yourself.
Well, thank you. Back in college, I used to have a... very, very late night radio show.
What did you play on your show?
Well, it would start out pretty lively music at midnight, and then as the evening went on, it would be more and more mellow music, Miles Davis and things like that. The longer the song, the more shut I could get at 2:30 in the morning.
Exactly. Like all DJs, he has to go to the bathroom and he puts on Hey Jude, you know, and
yeah,
he's
exactly.
gone.
Exactly.
Well, I hear that your question has something to do with reclaiming a little piece of your childhood.
Yeah, this is a cross between fulfilling a childhood dream and confronting a midlife crisis.
Okay.
Back when I was 13, I had a poster of this gorgeous Alfa Romeo Spider Veloce on my wall.
Ooh, good
Ooh,
car.
I even like those.
Good car.
Gorgeous, right?
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks ago, I turned 38 years old. In preparation of my 40th birthday and my midlife crisis, I want to sock away like maybe $700 a month for the next couple of years to save up for on my 40th birthday to buy like an old convertible two-seater sports car.
Jeremy, I got to say, you're a credit to your gender that you're anticipating your midlife crisis well in advance.
I'm a planner.
Well, okay, so I have to ask, are there any women in the home who have something to say about this $700 a month?
Yes, I have an extremely gracious and accepting wife. So she's okay with it as long as once we have the car, it doesn't become a complete and total money pit, which it might.
Which it will. No, not might. Not which might. It yeah. will. Do you have an income that can accommodate $700 in savings on a monthly basis?
For a short period of time, yes.
All right. Is your question then what to do with that money so it sits tight?
Or is this a knuckleheaded thing to do? That'd be
well,
the other question.
I guess both.
No, he's not asking us that, actually.
No, I guess he isn't. He's committed.
He made that decision.
Well, no, I do have, you know, a few qualms because I know this is not the best use of my money. But, yeah, the other question is where should I be stashing those savings for the next 2 years?
All right. Well, David, would you like to answer the question that he's not asking?
This is a guy thing. Tess, you should totally split, leave the room. We guys will talk among ourselves right now.
No, I will stay to help you be responsible.
Okay, because you're not going to understand what I'm about to say. First of all, I think you are totally on the right track in anticipating the toy that you know you're going to want to buy in relatively short order. I admire the fact that he's got a plan. So now the question is, how do you do it? How
yeah,
do you
where
set
do you put
aside?
That money?
I'd say a money market fund. It's not going to make you much, if anything, in the way of interest. The best thing about a fund like that, though, is that you can create it as a tool, as a saving tool, mm-hmm. because there will be a pool of money set aside in a certain account to which you'll be doing this. And if you really wanted to be smart about it, you would make an automatic withdrawal from your paycheck. I would probably do $500 because I like round numbers, and it just seems a little more amenable. And if that means you're going to have a slightly longer time frame, well, that's the price of being a grown-up.
I think all that makes sense. The other nice thing I think about doing it over a two-year period is if when I turn 40 and it turns out that we can't afford it, at least we have some savings built up. Or more likely if my wife gets cold feet on on the permission.
Well, how about this? In 2 years, she gets to spend the same amount of money on something she likes for her midlife crisis.
Oh, Tess, you so don't get what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we clearly can't afford both of those types of indulgence.
Oh, I bet you could. It's all about choices, my friend.
Did you miss the phrase midlife crisis earlier on in this conversation?
Women have them too, David.
And they set aside their own money.
Wait, with their own money? Are you saying his money versus her money?
I'm not. I'm saying we have a plan to buy the totally coolest car in the world, and you're telling me what, that we're going to go buy handbags and things? I don't think so.
Maybe you should be at least planning to take her up to wine country in Napa, Sonoma, once you get the car.
That would be very much appreciated. I think my wife would love that.
Okay.
Wine
well, there
country.
You go. That's what I'm here for.
French Laundry restaurant. Make your reservation 10 years in advance. You'll love it.
Then I might need to bump up that savings for French Laundry.
You probably will. All right, Jeremy. Hey, I want you to give us a call in a couple of years and let us know how this went.
I'll stop by in the bright new shiny red car by your studio.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, honestly, David, I think I let both of you off the hook way too easily on that.
It's a guy thing. You just don't get it.
Oh, come on. Get over it.
Deal with it.
All right. You know what? I want to know what our listeners think about this. $700 a month times 24 months. $17,000.
Yeah, I'm not sure how he's going to afford that car at that price.
Well, that's actually a very good point. But
I
want to hear from our listeners about what they think. Should Jeremy be buying this car or not? And I'm going to be very curious what the men say versus what the women say.
Make sure that you specify your gender so we understand who's credible here and who's not.
All right. Well, I suppose we should go to our next caller. And let me ask you before we get there, do you play an instrument?
There was a time when I would have claimed to have played the clarinet, but a Benny Goodman, I was not.
Well, our next caller, Brandon, is from one of the music capitals of the world. My kind of town, Chicago, is. Are you a working musician, Brandon?
Not quite yet, just in graduate school currently.
And what is your instrument?
I play the bassoon.
Do you have the bassoon with you by any chance?
I do.
Would you play a little something for us?
Sure, give me 1 second.
Fantasia.
I see Mickey directing at the
Sorcerer's
top of the mountain.
Sorcerer's Apprentice, isn't it?
It surely was.
Oh, that's just wonderful. Are you hoping that bassoon will be your career? You want to be in an orchestra? Or?
I very much would love that, very much.
Have you started auditioning yet?
I have.
And are you graduating?
I do have another year in my graduate program, but hopefully I can get a job so I don't have to work anymore with loans.
Well, so is that what you're calling about? You need some help with those loans?
Not directly. Many times when people go to audition for orchestras, they have to take care of all of the payments themselves. You know, flights, hotels, food.
So it costs a lot of money to get a job.
Exactly. And trying to figure out ways that I can try and fund the audition tours that are going on right now.
All right. So what kind of ideas do you have?
Well, I had sort of in the back of my head using my bassoon sort of as collateral.
Isn't your bassoon like your baby?
Yeah, it very much is.
You really want it to become collateral?
Well, it was just in the back of my head. You know, it wasn't, yes, I'm going to do this. I just wanted to get an idea of going to like a bank or something like that and using it for a secured loan through a bank.
All right. Well, the answer to that is forget about it. You basically are not going to be able to put up for a secured loan a musical instrument and keep the collateral. The idea that someone is going to give you money and say, go ahead and keep the bassoon, you nut. The bank doesn't want to foreclose on a home, but if they do, they got a reasonably good chance of flipping it.
Right.
They close on a bassoon, and they've got a bassoon.
Yeah.
Well, so I think we're basically saying, no, this is not an option for you.
What we're saying is don't borrow a lot of money if you don't have to. So I think the answer is going to have to be some sort of extra work, more lessons.
Right.
Another fallback, too. There isn't a lot of grants and funding out there in the arts community, but you never know. Check around. See what your community might be able to offer. Maybe a national grant is not going to come your way, but there might be some sort of program that helps students of the arts.
Well, thank you.
Hey, let us know how that audition goes.
I certainly will. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email your question. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, it's been fun as always.
I'm going to go practice my clarinet right now.
Okay, and I hope you're going to go buy a car as well.
Good one, a fancy one.
Yeah. And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. Remember about a month ago when I mentioned that if you had done all the proper financial planning, right now is an incredible time to buy a house. Mortgage rates are at historic lows, I said. Well, scratch that. Now they're at even more historic lows, 4.56% for the average 30-year fixed. We wondered whether that might be enough to get some fence sitters to finally jump off. So we called up a few realtors and asked what they're hearing from potential homebuyers.
My name is Lindsay Johnston. I am a real estate broker in Philadelphia. What I do see is a whole lot of possible buyers that aren't even testing the waters because they're just convinced that they're not even going to qualify for a mortgage. People are under the impression that banks are not lending. Sometimes it looks like you've got to be Jesus' little brother in order to get a loan.
Kara Marie Gibson. I'm with Keller Williams Platinum Partners out of Lee Summit, Missouri. Right now, it seems the biggest issue hasn't been getting the buyer qualified, but it has been on the appraisal. Like right now, we found buyers that are willing to pay a certain price. However, since the comparables in the area have been slower lately, it's harder to justify that value.
My name is Carol Ann Stahl, and I have been a realtor since 1983. Atlanta never had the wildly inflated prices. People that I'm working with are getting mortgages because they have job stability, they have good credit. People know that, hey, the credit crunch is out there. And so if there's any doubt in their minds, they're just not looking.
Okay, so there's some perspective from the East Coast, Midwest, the Deep South. Of course, anyone who's bought a home knows the old chestnut about all real estate being local. But you just heard some fairly similar views of the housing market. We decided to find out what's going on just a few miles from our studios in an area of Los Angeles called Mid-Wilshire, near Beverly Hills. Hey, it was a nice day outside, okay?
The house has an Eastern feel about it in the country English style.
We met up with Peter Wendell, a 20-plus year veteran of the L.A. real estate wars. He was holding an open house for fellow agents.
And with this big back porch, which is very typical of an East Coast or even Midwest property where everybody can sit on the nice porch and view the beautiful backyard.
How many square feet?
It's about 2,400 square feet, and the lot is about 7,500, which is a good size for this neighborhood.
The listing price for those 2,400 square feet? Just under $1.2 million. Like I said, all real estate is local, and Beverly Hills does not reflect, well, anything. But I asked whether the current price of mortgages was bringing out more potential buyers.
Well, interest rates definitely are a key factor for people being motivated to buy. What's coupled with that, though, it's very difficult to get a loan under normal circumstances, especially as compared to 2 or 3 years ago when all you had to do was be breathing to get a loan.
Right.
Even though buyers are interested in purchasing, they have to be put through the hoops with the lenders.
Do you find that people are coming out and looking purely because they're seeing the interest rates are at historic lows?
Not that as much as all of last year, everything was in such turmoil, people just sort of put things on hold.
Huh.
And interest rates were relatively low last year also, but
right.
People were just totally not knowing whether they're coming or going.
As we talk about a reason to get into the housing market with these historically low interest rates, what are you hearing from your potential buyers about the ability to get the loan?
The lenders are still, it's a total fruit basket upset as far as how they do their business. And especially where they've merged three or four banks together, sometimes you don't even know to the last minute whether the loan's going to go through, and sometimes at the last minute the loan doesn't go through. For an example, they've done an appraisal on the property, and then just a week before the close, the lender decides we need to do a review appraisal. And they send out a different appraiser, and that appraiser comes up with a lower value, and it skews the whole thing.
And this could be within, what, 30, 60 days of the last one?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we've heard that, you know, the advice is, hey, you know, if you have a great credit score, if you have the income, if you have the ability to pay the loan, you're going to be able to go out and buy a house. But it sounds like it's not even as easy as that.
Well, you definitely want to have those things, but then...
But that's just the starting point.
That's the starting point, right. And the appraisal situation has been the most difficult situation at this point.
How so?
Well, actually, want to talk to one of these guys here?
Sure, yeah. We have a couple other agents
come
here.
Come on. Yeah, come on, man.
So tell us who you are and what you do.
John Barentine with Keller Williams Realty Larchmont, and I've been selling homes for 21 years.
Well, what's your take on how much of a role the historic interest rates are playing in people deciding finally to come out and look at houses?
Very little, I think, actually. Oh. I think it has to do more with the economy in general and people feeling secure with their purchase.
Meaning what? That they just think things are getting
meaning
better?
Meaning that as volatile as the market has been over the last 24 months, that there's still a lot of fear and trepidation in the market. And I find that people tend to be fear-based.
What are they afraid of at this point?
They're afraid of the other shoe dropping.
That, or like a double-dip recession?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the media fuels that for them on a daily basis.
So when you have new clients coming to you, what are they saying about the reason for coming out now?
The buyers that do have faith in the market, those are the buyers of the moment. They also believe that prices are at historic lows.
But it sounds like what you're saying really is, and I think that we find this in general in the population, that there is a bifurcation of whether people believe that we are in a full economic recovery or whether
yes.
they're in the camp that really believes the folks who are saying there's more real pain yet to come.
Well, if you read the news on a daily basis, it's not bright and sunny.
Right.
You know, I mean, so you really have to have a personal theory about what's happening with the market. And I think at this one, everyone does. And so those that have made their mind up that this is not the time to buy, they should not be buying. But those that are well-educated about the market and feel that the value is there, they're definitely moving forward and taking advantage of a great opportunity right now.
So, Peter, that's really interesting what John was saying about the division within potential homeowners is the same that's going on with, you know, investors and anyone involved in this economy, that it's whether you have a positive outlook on it or whether you have a negative outlook on it.
That coupled with the people who are sitting by the sidelines that don't want to wait any longer, because I've found that happens in every market that's going up or down or uncertain. Many people will wait until they think that they know what's going to happen. And when they realize that they don't know what's going to happen, but enough time has gone by,
right.
Then they act anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much.
Oh,
really appreciate
it. It was a pleasure having you.
bringing us to this home. And can we take a tour?
You certainly may.
And you can find a slideshow of that tour at marketplace.org. While those would-be homeowners are deciding whether to get off the sidelines, lots of current homeowners are trying to figure out what to do about their mortgages. The government's fix-it programs and the banks that are supposed to implement them appear to be generating more madness than modifications. Here are a few stories that came through our inbox.
My name is Ann Cornwell. I live in Gastonia, North Carolina. My experiences with Wells Fargo, wherein not just once but twice, they closed my file after the 45-day deadline to complete documentation because of, quote-unquote, lack of documentation. In both cases, the lack of documentation was 100% due to their not telling me that there was deficiency in the documents. I had had over 20 phone conversations with various reps, and now a rep was telling me she could send me a packet and I could start all over again.
My name is Ann Harz, and I'm from Los Angeles, California. Chase Bank claims that it takes 30 to 60 days to process a Making Homes Affordable loan modification. However, the application process with Chase has seemed more like something out of Kafka's novel, The Castle, a saga of a frustrating bureaucratic maze. On Chase Bank statements, the last page always reads, left intentionally blank, but they do not number this last page. For example, a Chase account may have 6 pages and all the pages say 1 of 6, 2 of 6, etc. But page 6, the blank one, is not numbered 6 of 6. We have been continually turned down for a mortgage modification because we are not sending them, Chase, complete bank statements, even though we send them the sixth page. Since it doesn't say six of six, they claim our application isn't complete and make us start all over from the very beginning.
Hi, this is Anita Sinkowski, and I'm from Essexville, Michigan. In May 2007, I began the process of working toward a deed in lieu of foreclosure. My original servicer had been acquired by City Mortgage, and after nearly finishing the process, I was told I'd have to start all over. As you can understand, I couldn't face beginning the whole process again, so I researched City Mortgage Sucks on Google. From there, I was able to learn the name of the then CEO, and using local property records, I found his home address and discovered his home phone number. I wrote a very tense but businesslike letter and sent it by FedEx for delivery at his home on a Saturday morning. After spending most of the weekend ducking the cops I thought he'd dispatched to roust me, I heard from a member of his staff on the following Monday. So it pays to start at the top.
Of course, not everyone will be lucky enough to get to the top. We call that an entrepreneurial spirit for sure. But we recently aired a story about a group of community activists who held a demonstration outside JPMorgan Chase offices here in Southern California. An executive actually did come out and meet with them. One of the questions raised in that piece was why banks don't have, or at least don't use, all the tools available to them when modifying mortgages, like reducing the principal instead of just the interest rate. We asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to follow up.
In Arizona, which has been especially hard hit, Sharon Gallagher has watched the value of her Phoenix home plunge. She's making her payments, but after our story, she posted a comment on our website suggesting Chase ought to start meeting her and other borrowers halfway.
Why can't they put some skin in the game? We have skin in the game. Why can't they put some in? Why did they get a bailout?
Gallagher wonders why Chase can't split the difference. She could eat, say, $50,000 of her loss if Chase would do the same. That might keep her from walking away from an investment that she's convinced will never be worth what she pays. That happens to be the same kind of message those protesters delivered at their Los Angeles rally the other day.
I'd like to know, is Chase willing to reduce the principals to the value of the home?
Why don't you drop principal to market values today on all those homes?
But they didn't hear the answer they wanted from Gary Kishner, the spokesman sent down by the bank to address the crowd.
The goal a borrower wants is a lower payment, is that correct? We believe we can lower the payment the same way, reducing interest rate, amortizing the loan over 40 years. And we're achieving the same exact thing, which is lowering your payment and keeping you in your... Sir, hold on one second. And keeping the borrower in their home.
Deborah Beard was one of the struggling homeowners there that day. Chase promises she's now on the bank's priority list, but she's still worried the plan the bank wants to follow will leave her mortgage way too far underwater.
At the time that I signed the papers for the loan, my home was worth $395,000. At this point, my home is only worth $169,000.
She says Chase has offered to reduce interest and extend her loan for the next 28 years, at which point a balloon payment of $157,000 would be due.
Add the interest charges onto that, you've got like $200,000, $300,000 worth of debt still. So you never own the home. It never comes to an end.
That presumes, of course, the home doesn't recover its value, but L.A. community activist Peter Koons says cases like that really amount to a lifetime rental agreement, and it's little wonder mortgage modifications without principal forgiveness are more likely to fail. Better, he says, for the banks to compromise on the amount actually owed.
We believe it makes good business sense. There's a strong argument that in many cases, banks stand to gain more taking some hit on the principal than foreclosing and having the home sit vacant for a long period of time.
Still, the Obama administration says fewer than 10% of modified loans involve principal reductions, which is why some proponents are pushing for government incentives. So far, though, banks remain reluctant. They fear cutting balances for some will spur others to default to get the same discount. Representatives of Bank of America, Citibank, Chase, and Wells Fargo appeared at a recent congressional hearing, and they all made it clear they consider principal reductions a last resort in limited cases. David Lohman heads the home lending division of JPMorgan Chase.
Broad-based principal reduction could result in decreased access to credit and higher cost for consumers because lenders will price for principal forgiveness risk.
In other words, all borrowers could end up paying for these kinds of loan modifications if they become a new cost of doing business. He also warned they could lead to a new wave of deeper losses banks can still ill afford.
A broad-based principal reduction program could have an industry-wide cost of $700 billion to $900 billion.
Yet another sticking point is fairness. Texas Republican Randy Neugebauer complained at that hearing of the House Financial Services Committee that the wrong people are being rewarded, while most homeowners are doing what's necessary to pay what they owe.
Their neighbor leveraged up their house, bought a boat, charged up a bunch of stuff, put a second lien on their home, and now they're going to get created equity by either a federal program or your lending, and the people that are making their mortgage payment are going to be the losers, and there's something wrong with the system that supports that.
Critics argue mortgages don't come with a money-back guarantee, and encouraging loan principal reduction just promotes a sense of entitlement, although Deborah Beard says her neighbors don't begrudge her asking for a break.
What we have had was neighbors to say, you know, I wish you guys good luck, or I'm praying with you guys, or, you know, I was almost in that same position, or even a couple have said, I'm in the same position.
And community activist Peter Coons asks, with only a few hundred thousand mortgages modified out of millions still underwater, who's really acting entitled?
Is there a sense of entitlement for bankers that have received billions and billions of dollars in bailout money and continue to compensate their top executives with multi-million dollar bonuses?
Coons contends bankers should be the last ones to blame homeowners for making bad decisions. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
And a few final cents for you to ponder, actually just one. Because of the recession, the 99-cent store hiked prices to a whopping 99.99 cents. Of course, cash registers can't register that, so they round up. And now, two class action lawsuits filed this month say that extra penny amounts to false advertising. Krista Farron is with the marketing research firm Mintel International, and she says the chain is within the letter of the law, but it could take a hit in the court of public opinion.
Other competitors like Family Dollar and Dollar General, they have a bit more wiggle room because their brand promise is a little bit softer. But for 99 cent only, that exact price is built right into the store name. So I think it's tough for consumers to get past that.
Suffice it to say, the lawsuits are asking for more than just that one red cent. Customers may have overpaid. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, asking for a raise is never easy, especially in this economy.
He looked me in the eye and he said, I could get people like you for $10,000 a year and a hot lunch at noon.
Nice. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Angela Kim. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. The theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.